Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paul Theroux, whose latest book is Deep South. It's a travel book traveling through the South. Last year, a collection of 20 stories, Mr. Bones, came out, and we'll talk a little about that.
Sure.
And also, various novels are being reissued, most recently Picture Palace.
Yes.
From the 1970s. But we're going to start with talking about Deep South. This is a travel book, but it's the first travel book set in the United States. There have been 30 books of fiction, 17 books of nonfiction, most of which have been travel books. What prompted you to go into the South? What prompted you to start looking around this country?
The last trip I took, I was in Southern Africa. It was an extension of the Dark Star Safari trip. I went from Cairo to Cape Town. I thought, I'll go from Cape Town as far north as I can make it. I thought Congo, Timbuktu, Nigeria wasn't quite. But by the time I got to the northern Angola, I had sort of given up. And the last chapter of that book is called, What Am I Doing Here? And I seriously wondered why I was traveling in Africa in a place that was like a suburb of America. I mean, kids, rappers, guys with their baseball hats turned backwards, graffiti, kind of poverty that I thought resembled the urban poverty that you see in the States, homeless people, panhandlers, and a corrupt government. Angola is a very wealthy country, but it was in Angola that I thought, I'm going down these red roads in Angola. There are red roads in the South, and I know there's deprivation in the South, antebellum mansions and Magnolia and football games. But I thought, I want to see what American peasantry looks like, what American poverty looks like, what the American back roads look like. I had never traveled there. I'd only seen it earlier in my life. In the 50s, I was there with my uncle, back again in the 70s. I never really penetrated the back roads. And I thought, I've been everywhere, but I really haven't traveled in the States. And I thought, I could take a road trip, a quintessential American trip, take all my stuff with me, not go through TSA. I can bring a Swiss Army knife. I can bring a case of wine. I can bring a raincoat. And I have my own car. So that's what I did. It's essentially a road trip in search of the submerged 20th to 30th. You know, of course you do, because you come from this part of California. Jack London's book, People of the Abyss. One of my favorite books. He goes to London. He ignores everything that's happening in central London. He goes to East London. Well, the abyss in America is the Deep South. I didn't know how long it was going to take. I took the trip. I thought, this is really paradise for me. Not in terms of bliss. The bliss was to travel. The people I met were the important aspect of it. For almost 2 years, I was back and forth on the back roads.
The book is divided into four different seasons, and I interviewed you, I guess, between season 3 and season 4, and you were talking about how the poverty resembled Africa. When I was reading Deep South, I noticed something else, which is that, you know, if you're in Des Moines, if you're in Walnut Creek, if you're in Lake George, you can drive along, and so much of it is the same. It's the same stores, the same restaurants. The sense I get from the backwoods of the Deep South in your book, Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas, is that it's not that America. It's a different America.
It's the real America. I mean, that's a very interesting comment that you made. The places that you alluded to are cities or urban centers. The urban centers of the South resemble each other. The South is not in its cities. It's not in Birmingham. It's not in Atlanta. It's Southern, but it is not culturally, it's not the same as the back roads of Alabama, Mississippi. Go up the Delta. You think, is this America? Yeah, yeah. That's the real America. That's where it's happening. Go to Chicago. There are whole streets of Indians from India, or there's Haitians, and there's, you know, everything else. That sort of ethnic mix doesn't exist in the South. There are Indians running gas stations and motels, but the South has retained its identity, its cultural identity, and its history, and the people's stories are local, and they're deep. The roots are deep. The people that you meet in the South, that I met, were the people who built the South. Go to any part of America, the Des Moines that you mentioned, or New York or Boston, and you meet basically immigrants. Or you might meet a few locals, but it's a great mix of people, not mixing up too much. But there was a cultural memory in the South that you don't find in other places. And that's why if you're traveling, you want to hear people's stories and you want to hear what this place is like. People talk about Southern fiction, but the South, the present South, is not in Southern fiction. Southern fiction is dated, most of it. Nothing that I read before I went prepared me for what I found in the South.
Were you expecting more or less a little bit of Africa, but mostly the strip malls?
I didn't know what to expect. Wherever you go in America, there are strip malls. There aren't many in the Delta. You could travel from outside Natchez, of course, outside Vicksburg, of course. But most of the Delta is very poor. It's farmland, both on the Arkansas side and the Mississippi side. I was seeing landscapes that were completely new to me. I mean, you expect the stereotypes. As I say, the mansions, the magnolias, the horse paddocks and so forth. So I wasn't surprised when there was a steeplechase or fox hunting or a beauty contest. That you expect. What I didn't expect were people living so far below the poverty line that they were living in an almost complete hopelessness without any notion that they would ever leave it. And they were living in towns that had once had industries, making furniture, shoes, and electronics in some places in Arkansas, textiles, carpets, and so forth. They don't make them anymore. The South has been hollowed out. The manufacturers left and made fortunes elsewhere. And these are the people, Tim Cook, Phil Knight, Gates, Buffett, all those people say, we want to lift Americans out of poverty. But they took the jobs away from them. That's another sort of aspect of the book.
We'll get into the race in a minute, but some of the political aspect you're talking about is how NAFTA and the Clintons in particular, that's what destroyed the South.
Yeah, it is. NAFTA destroyed the South, and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be the final nail in the coffin. It's horrible. Well, Clinton is responsible also for giving China preferred status as a trading partner. Wonderful guy. You want to know Clinton? Go to Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hot Springs is this demented, vulgar, weird place with a history of racism, whoring and gambling and gangsterism. Clinton grew up and went to a white high school. He didn't have any black friends. White high school, white neighborhood. The black part of Hot Springs now is as black as it ever was. The white part is white. It's still a segregated town. Clinton has his virtues. I'm not bashing the man. But Arkansas is so deprived, it's so weird, that you don't really understand someone like Clinton till you go to Arkansas and say, oh, now I understand the paradoxes of the man who would say anything to get elected. Signs NAFTA saying, oh, we're going to deliver jobs. And there's no jobs. It was just a disappearance of the jobs in Forest City and Wynn and in Hot Springs, too, for that matter, and in Little Rock. You know, people say, read Southern fiction, read Southern writing, or listen to these political figures. You find nothing. They're all either lying or distorting, or they're not up to date. You got to go there. But anyone can go there. I never took a trip like this. I never got in a car and drove so easily, in any, not in China, not in India, not in anywhere.
And you were free to do it without anybody stopping you along the way. You decided not to go to Louisiana. Why?
I went to northern Louisiana. I crossed from Natchez. I went down to the Red River. I'm very interested in Thomas Hart Benton, Benton the painter. And Benton received a lot of inspiration from traveling in the South. He was really a tremendous traveler and wrote an excellent travel book called An Artist in America. So I went to a lot of Benton places in Louisiana, the Red River, and then the middle part, and then up Monroe, and then the Arkansas border, which is Benton territory and also Charles Portis territory.
But you didn't go down south toward New Orleans and
no.
That culture.
There's no coastal part that I went to. The coastal parts, they're too mixed. Most of them are kind of prosperous. I wanted to go to the heartland of the heartland. There's no picturesque, there's no Cajun, there's no Gullah, there's no Geechee people, there's no, none of that. It's all country people, rural people, back roads, no cities. First, I hate cities. I hate urban life. Urban life is nasty. One city is pretty much like another. Even as I say, Luanda, Angola isn't a million miles different from Lagos, from Miami, from, you know, lots of other places. They're corrupt people living cheek by jowl. Or they're people just I don't know, coping, with no elbow room. I was looking for the freedom of the open road, and also was intentionally looking for stories, looking for people, not sightseeing, not looking for architecture, looking for human architecture, people, their stories, and the contradictions. Because if you listen to a lot of writers or a lot of politicians describing the United States, they're not giving you the real story. They're shining you on.
Paul Theroux, you spent a lot of time with African Americans in the South, probably more time than with the white people of the South.
Yeah.
What revelations, if any, did you have about race in the South, particularly what we think about race in the South here in the West and North, compared to what it's actually like?
It's a very difficult question because it's a big question. But one of the perceptions I had was that education has been defunded. It's been defunded in South Carolina. It's been defunded in Alabama, Mississippi. And it's not that great in Arkansas. So the schools that weren't doing particularly well, and we're talking about black schools mainly, lost a lot of their funding. And so kids dropped out. The only way that you can shine in the South is by leaving. People leave, they go north, they go to Chicago, they go to New York, they come to California, and things happen to them. Or they join the army. I met lots of African Americans whose whole lives were shaped by the fact that they joined the services, fought. If you're looking for wounded veterans, the South is full of them. Politically, the new tensions in the South are curious because a lot of the city governments, town governments, are black. Black mayor, black alderman, black dog catcher. And the towns still aren't doing well. Selma, for example, you know, it was once a white town, the standoff, the Selma Bridge. Voting statistics aren't that great there, although people fought and died, as John Lewis or any of them, to get the vote. So they got the vote. When I say they, everyone got the vote. So there's a black Selma. But Selma is a sad place. Selma has no business. Selma, Alabama, is a place really on its uppers. Monroeville, south, where Harper Lee lives, the place is tragic. There are injustices, too, racial injustices, and those have been uncovered by a man called Brian Stevenson. The idea that Selma is a symbol of victory, ask Oprah, ask Barack Obama, ask Michelle, ask Beyonce, Jesse Jackson, all were down there for a photo op. Then they got in a plane and left. They never mentioned the fact that Selma is struggling economically. So you talk about racial disparities. It's a great thing to have the vote. It's a great thing to have people in power. But there's no money there, and there's no investment. The investment is all somewhere else. Whites also have a problem. But one of the characteristics of the South, of Southern education, is that any town in the South has a white academy. After the schools were integrated, academies were started. The one in Monroeville, which is basically a white school, has great results. But any town, Greensboro, Alabama, white school, Vicksburg, Natchez, there's a white, private, fee-paying academy in a part of the landscape.
There's an indication, I think someone says it in Deep South, Paul Theroux, someone says that, in fact, the racial divide is greater now than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, people say that. I heard that. I guess it means that it seemed like getting the vote or having people in power would change things. People tend to keep to their own churches. There are black churches, there are white churches. The barbershop, it's black, it's white. You know, there's a black barbershop where you'll never see a white face. And I deliberately went to black barbershops to talk to people because I knew that it was like going to the black Elks Club, you know. And
how was it being the only white guy there? How did they treat you?
Well, because, well, first they assume I'm not local. I'm just a wanderer. They first establish, is he drunk? Is he on drugs? It's like saying hello to a person in New England. You say hello and they look at you. Are you drunk? You just said hello to me. In the South, everyone says hello. Funeral parlors have segregated. Churches are segregated. Barbershops are segregated. Those may never change. But in terms of achievement, you know, if you don't have education, you go nowhere. And for some reason, the Republican governments in the Deep South, the state governments, the governors, Nikki Haley, Bobby Jindal, Arkansas, Alabama, all that, they say we don't have the money for education. I'm talking about primary education, high schools and so forth. They ain't got it. And they don't have the will or the teachers. It's like you see them and you think, Jesus, what you need is the Peace Corps. You know, send the Peace Corps here. There are AmeriCorps people there trying to do their best. But you need willpower. But also, you need people who have a reason for living. Jimmy Carter's down banging up houses and saying, I'm going to give you a Habitat for Humanity houses. If people have a job, they apply for a mortgage, they get a house. They don't need Jimmy Carter. They can build their own damn house. First, you need education, you need training, you need work. 600 million Chinese have been lifted out of poverty by the outsourced companies in the past 15 years. So why not do it in the States?
You do mention several times that there's all of this aid money, including the Clinton Foundation, that goes off to Africa and other third world places, and none of it finds its way to the poverty in the United States.
As a matter of fact, the Clinton Foundation gets its money from industries. Coke gives its money. IBM gives its money. Apple gives its money. So Clinton is a great fundraiser. I mean, he's tremendous. Charismatic figure. We know that. He's weird. I find him like a fictional character. God knows what kind of a private life. He said, I'm entitled to my privacy, to which I'd say, that's great. So am I. Why is the FBI spying on me? Why are you listening to my email? You want a private life? Give me a private life. I have a file. I was turned down for a job one time in Singapore because the FBI said I was unreliable. I'd gotten into trouble as an activist in the 60s, picketing the White House and then making a fuss about the Vietnam War. I had trouble in Africa with the government there. They're spying on me. What about Clinton? But to return to the Clinton Foundation, instead of giving him money to address third world issues, why not start companies in the South? Why not invest in the South? People don't want handouts. It's not like Mrs. Jellyby in Bleak House saying, oh, well, they can make piano legs and we'll give them food for that and then convert them. People actually need work. And if you look at the South, not the cities in the South, the cities actually have some investment. The rural areas in the South have no investment to speak of and no banks. There's such a thing as bank deserts, a place where there's no bank. There's nowhere to get money. You can't go in. You can't borrow. And you don't have a car, so you can't drive anywhere. So you're just stuck. And the nearest bank is, God knows where, 100 miles away.
That reminds me of Alabama's new, the ID, voter ID law. And then they close all the DMVs in the poor areas so people can't get their IDs.
Yeah, that's terrific. You were asking about investment abroad. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and I'm very interested in it. I've been critical of investment abroad, the way it's given. Just there always seems to be an agenda to it. And there's some weird high contrast between, Clinton might be a great example, actually, of going to Nairobi and 10,000 people showing up cheering, Jambo Habari, Jambo Habari, Jambo Clinton, Jambo Bwana Bwana. And I think he glories in that. He seems to lust for glory. Well, there's no glory in the South. I mean, it's pretty dull lifting people out of poverty by giving them jobs. But what you do is you start and train people, as they did in Vietnam. Is there some great tradition in Vietnam of making Nikes? I don't think so. They're all trained soldiers and rice farmers and, planting rice. But now they can make LeBron James $320 sneakers. Well, anyone can do that. Anyone can be trained to do it.
When you were in the back areas of the South, the other thing that seemed missing was the new technological age. I don't recall much mention of iPhones, GPS, texting, computers. Did you see many Wi-Fi spots, or is that just a different universe?
That's a great question. That's a great question. And as a matter of fact, no, you don't see. There's not a lot of technology. People have phones. They have, cell phones. But you don't see a lot of technology. Another thing you don't see a lot of? Books. You don't have a house anywhere in a poor area, even a kind of low middle class area, and there's no books. The people who actually had books in the house were so few in number that I can tell you the names of the people whose houses I saw where I saw books. A farmer's not necessarily going to have a shelf of, the New York edition of Henry James, but there's no books. So no technology, no books is a feature. And this is why, when people talk about the South, they mention Chekhov, because it's very Chekhovian. Just to go in and there's a fly buzzing. They're like Chekhov's peasants or Chekhov's bourgeoisie to a certain extent. And it's just a hot day and there's someone plowing outside and there's a mule or something. And, yeah, that's it. That's an America that has existed, from the dawn of time.
It's odd. You went to the Arkansas Literary Festival, and nobody knew who you were. Some woman called you Paul Thorax.
Yeah, I didn't mind being called Paul Thorax. But what she said was, what sort of things do you write, Mr. Thorax? Which is different from being Paul Thorax. But that's okay. In fact, that's my triumph of anonymity. I really don't want to be recognized. It must be a pleasure to you, Richard. You go and interview people. People might recognize your voice, but you don't want to be a recognizable face. You want to talk to people. You're an interesting guy, but the people that you interview are really the focus of the whole effort. And when I go, I really don't want to go to a place and people say, oh, you're Paul Theroux, you're the writer. Would you like a hamburger? I'd rather be despised or treated just like everybody else, because there's the story. There is the story. And at the literary festival that you mentioned, I wanted to talk to John Lewis. John Lewis had these people, he had a kind of posse of people protecting him. And when they saw me, it was a wet day. I had, you know, wet shoes, wet hat, wet coat. I looked like a peckerwood. I looked like a cracker. And the John Lewis people and his entourage looked at me, and they really looked at me as though I might be trouble. Like, who's this peckerwood? Mr. Thorax. So I like that, actually, because there's a real response. If I was Harrison Ford, they'd say, oh, you're Harrison Ford. I loved you in Indiana Jones. But I'm not. I'm nobody. I'm every man, you know, every old white guy. The last chapter in the book, which is one of my favorite chapters, is called Old Man. It's about being an old man traveling, invisible, anonymous, like the river, Old Man River. And they call the river the old man, too.
Paul Thorax, a quick question. You've been in poor areas in Hawaii. Is there any relationship between those poor areas there and those in the South?
No, because Hawaii is a special case in the same way that Santa Monica is. Hawaii has great weather. You can sleep on the beach in Hawaii. Hawaiian homelessness and poverty is related to people coming from Micronesian islands, from Yap, from Truk, from Samoa. And Hawaiians look after each other. I mean, native Hawaiians will look after each other. But there's people from the mainland. People from California go, they get off the plane and apply for assistance, sleep on the beach, and we have a serious problem in Hawaii from homelessness and poverty too. But it's not homegrown. It's a lot of it is from recent immigrants, people who are, you know, opportunistic, who are there and then kind of looking for assistance. In the South, you don't find the same kind of homelessness in the South. You don't find, I mean, say go to a small town, Demopolis, Alabama, Greensboro, Alabama, Marion, Alabama, Mississippi. You don't find people sleeping on the street, you know, even on a warm day. Homelessness is different. You find people living in shacks, living on, you know, with an EBT card, maybe. But it's not like Hawaii. It's very visible in Hawaii. You know Hawaii. You've been there. And people think, oh, my God, I thought this was paradise. What's this all about? Actually, it's a serious problem. Poverty is a problem in the South. The poverty in the South is local and deep-rooted. And you don't find people adrift in the South in the same way.
You also went to several gun shows. You seem drawn to gun shows and black churches. There is a community connection there,
I think. Yes, that's right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. If you're traveling, you need to meet people, you have to look inoffensive, and you need to ingratiate yourself, talk to them, have some common theme. A church is a great place because a church has traditionally in the South been a refuge. So people go to churches in the South, of course, to listen to the sermon for spiritual uplift, but they also go for welfare. During the Civil Rights Movement, they went to find out how tactically to succeed about voter registration. They go, you know, to look for their children. They go for food. They go for help. So the church is, as you say, it's a community effort. Gun show is like going to a Masonic lodge. You go to a gun show, and people at a gun show assume that you agree with them about the government, about religion, about race, about everything. And the fact that you're there with a little tag on your hand means that you're one of them. And you can talk to them about anything. I mean, they're great talkers, but you usually in loud voices complaining about Obama, gun restrictions, whatever it is, you know, foreign aid, you know, foreigners and the whole business. And I see my role as a writer who's traveling as a listener. I'm not a provocateur. Gun shows were very revealing. One of the themes in Southern life that I saw is a sense of defeat. People feel weak and defeated. The gun shows, that sense of defeat is very palpable at a gun show.
And that's the defeat of the Confederates 150 years ago.
Yes, it's the Civil War, but it's also the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, a gun show is effectively a white male gathering. And they feel, well, I mean, it's a fact that the civil rights movement was a war, and it was a defeat for them. You know, each battle in the war, Selma was a battle, Birmingham was a battle. That's a sense of defeat. They feel defeated. Poverty is a defeat. They feel as if economically they've been defeated. Politically they've been defeated. In the larger picture, they're not represented by Washington. I felt, really, that people go to gun shows not to buy guns, but to talk, to meet, like the Elks Club or the Masons. They go to meet because they have common concerns. And that the gun is a symbol of the one thing that hasn't been taken from them. And if that's taken, when they lose the guns, they're going to think, well, we lost everything. People aren't going to gun shows, you know, most, so they can go out and massacre someone.
So it's almost as if Bernie Sanders, by saying, yeah, I'm in a rural area, keep your guns, would appeal to these people more than, say, what Hillary Clinton would have said in the debate.
But Bernie Sanders is right. I mean, Bernie Sanders is actually being truthful. It's not a popular thing to say to Democrats, because the popular thing to say is to appeal to the stereotype and say, no one should have guns, we've got to get rid of guns. But that's not going to work. I mean, you can't run on that platform. Hillary's going to make a deal out of it. But Bernie Sanders comes from a state, they don't have Uzis, they don't have AK-47s. They got shotguns, they got Mossberg 22s. They're plinking squirrels, they're shooting deer. Well, there might be people listening to this, and, you know, I feel that they have a case. But actually, this is a country of lots of people hunting. And hunters have rights. I think there should be background checks. But they'll never get rid of guns. They'll never. It will never happen. You can go at grandstand like Hillary and say, it's got to change. We have to change. But it ain't going to change. Bernie's right. He lost a lot of support there. But he was telling it like it is. He was being truthful to the people that elected him in Vermont.
Paul Theroux, let's change the subject for a minute here and talk about Mr. Bone's 20 stories. These were written over several years?
They were written over about a 4 or 5 year period, yeah.
Most of your novels have, as the main character, a version of yourself. The short stories, on the other hand, well, some of them do, most of them do not. Is that one of the appeal of writing the short stories?
Yes, and it's a very interesting question. I was very friendly with Leon Adel. Leon Adel, as you know, wrote the 5-volume biography of Henry James. And one day we were talking. He lived in Hawaii, and I miss him so much. I loved talking to him. He was really the most widely read person I've ever met. He read everything that Henry James ever wrote, and he met a lot of people that James knew, Edith Wharton and Walter Berry and all these people. So he told me once about, we were talking about the short story and talking about James, and he said, my feeling about the short story and James is that when Henry James was writing a short story, he was writing about a yearning, about what if this happened? What if I was in love with this woman? What if my life had been this way? He was writing not so much fantasy, but yearning. And these were feelings in James, the stories. You know, it could be The Beast in the Jungle or The Jolly Corner, whatever it is, that James's short stories represented his inner life. So you say that the characters in my stories don't resemble me, but they do, I can assure you, represent aspects of myself, of a deeper self. Leon Adel said that. That's not the reason I write short stories, but it explained the nature of my short stories, that the character is slightly different, but I can relate to all of them. They have a strong sense of who I am.
There's one short story that's actually not a short story. It's several short stories called Long Short Story Short. Were those written in sequence or just little scribbles that you eventually put together?
Yeah, the Long Story Short were one-page stories. I often thought if I were teaching writing, something I've never done, but if I were, I would say to the students, write a one-page story. It has to have a beginning, middle, and end, probably. It can be an anecdote. But write it in one page. You don't have to write Heart of Darkness. You don't have to write a Chekhov story or a Dubliners or whatever. Just write a one-page story. It's a great challenge. The master of this is Borges in Fictions and Labyrinth. The Borges story is just a page or a page and a half, and it's burned into your mind.
Years later, I could still remember them all.
Yes. And think how short they are. I collect them. Sometimes it's a story that someone tells me. Sometimes it's just a germ of an idea that I think I can make that into one page. Yeah, they're in this book. There are lots of them. I mean, there's scores of them in the book.
Were all the stories intended to be short stories, or were some of them novels that kind of just didn't become novels?
No, they're all short stories. I think that a short story is a very odd, very difficult thing to write. It's ideally about one thing. A novel is about everything. It's about a lot of things. A novel, as James said, is a loose and baggy monster. A short story isn't that way. A short story, concision is very important, and it has a point or a mood to it. Hemingway's often have a mood rather than a point. The planning of a short story, the rewriting of a short story, in my experience, is very difficult, and I sometimes labor over them. The ones in Mr. Bones, I think, are good stories. There are four or five that I didn't put in that book that I wrote that I didn't think were particularly successful, but the ones that are there, they're ones that I hope have permanent form.
Lately, because of the interviews I've been doing, I've been reading a lot more short stories than I normally read, and I notice one difference between a novel and a short story is that the ending of a novel on some level needs a payoff, and a short story does not.
As I said, a short story can have a mood. You have to have a reason for reading 200 or 300 pages of a novel. You need some reward at the end of it, an some sort of insight, whatever it is, a payoff, as you say. A short story doesn't need that, often doesn't have that, but folded within it is a payoff, and sometimes it takes a while for that to sink in.
On some level, I find that when I'm reading a short story, I'm reading it differently than I'm reading a novel. I mean, maybe a novella or novelette I'm reading the same way, but a short story of 10 or 15 pages, no. And if I get too caught up in what's going to happen next, I'm going to get screwed.
You're reading a short story, and it's 10 pages, and you start, and then you read a page, and then there's 9 pages, and you think, there's 9 pages left, then there's 8 pages, and you think, actually, where am I going? What's happening? You know, is this anything? You keep thinking, is this anything? And then you get halfway through, you're on page 5, and you think, is this anything? And you're hoping, hoping, hoping. With a novel you return to every night, the happy experience of returning to a novel and thinking, I'm going back to Madame Bovary. Madame Bovary's about to have another assignation with Rodolphe. She's a shopaholic. Her libido is on the boil. Her husband doesn't suspect anything, but the people in the town do. You know Madame Bovary. You know Humbert. You know Ishmael. You go back. What's going to happen? They become intimate friends. You know a fictional character better than you know your boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, husband, or the guy next door. You have this relationship with a fictional character that's very intense. You don't have it with a character in a short story. A character in a short story is a cameo. And there's not enough to deepen that character, but over 200 or 300 pages or more in a novel, the dimensions of that character, the emotions of that character deepen, and that person becomes a friend and a touchstone.
What is the relationship of the Paul Theroux in your travel books and the real Paul Theroux? Because he's a character.
You may say so, but I feel as if that's me talking. I don't really think there's much difference between the guy in Riding the Iron Rooster, talking about the Chinese, or the man walking around Britain in the Kingdom by the Sea, or the guy around the Mediterranean, or the Happy Isles of Oceania, that guy who was recently divorced and having a fairly awful time. That's me. A travel book is like letters home. It's like you're writing to the ideal recipient. You know, you write, you're sending it, and you're hoping the person will understand who you are and where you've been. Maybe earlier in my travel writing career, I put on airs, or I there are affectations, I think. Perhaps. I would grant you that. But you can't maintain any sense of affectation and have people believe you. I would like to think, as people say, you know, they say, what should I write about? I'm going to Afghanistan. I'm going to Albania. I'm going to Miami. What should I write about? I say, just tell the truth. See things as they are. You know, Suzuki, the great Zen master, said, you know, what should you do in life? See things as they are, he said.
I was reading the book. I noticed something, but then it turned up in a review and somebody made mention of it that Bishop Palmer, you made a comment about Chaucer.
Yeah.
Did you actually expect him to understand what you were saying and why?
Bishop Palmer was highly educated.
That's what I thought of.
Yeah, he went to college there, further degree, theological degree. He's a bishop. why wouldn't he know Chaucer? I assume that people read, and I'm continually surprised by how little they read or how little they know. He didn't know. I mean, I often make allusions. I was in Los Angeles, and we were sitting around, we were talking about Mark Twain, and I mentioned Pudd'nhead Wilson. And there was a lawyer there, highly educated, very wealthy, very well read. And I said, what do you think of Pudd'nhead Wilson? Have you read it? And he said, no. I said, okay, fine. But he had read Pudd'nhead Wilson? I thought, you know, any reasonably intelligent person, even if you just went to law school, whatever it is, why wouldn't you read it? It's about a lawyer. You're a lawyer. The guy was a lawyer. You're a lawyer. You should know lawyers in fiction. You know, Balzac has lawyers, and Somerset Maugham has lawyers, and Faulkner has lawyers, and Mark Twain has lawyers. I was surprised. So the answer to your question is, yeah, I would expect – his name is Palmer. I said, like, Palmer's forsaken, strange, stronger, infernal hallways, couth in sombre landers. Do you know that? And he looked at me like I was the man who fell to earth, his eyes glazing over, like, who might you be? Take your medication.
Recently you had an article in the Smithsonian about Harper Lee, and you went down to Monroeville. What did you find out? What did you learn?
I found out that I think to a certain extent Harper Lee is a figment of everyone's imagination. I mean, the woman can't write for Toffee. And then they published her first draft of the book. Read To Kill a Mockingbird with any critical sense, and you'll see that it's a very, very poor novel. But published at the right time. Flannery O'Connor called it a children's book. Well, it is. It's an oversimple look at race relations in the South. Published in 1960, set in 1930. It's a simple version. You know, it's the Harry Potter version of... So I have no regard for her writing. What I found in Monroeville was that it actually created a small industry of, you know, there's a play, there's a gift shop. The woman herself lives in an old folks' home just outside of town, at the edge of town, and doesn't talk to anyone. She has had the weirdest career of anyone. I mean, they're saying, well, what about her next novel? Do you think Harper will write another novel? And she was, you know, even Truman Capote. Well, Truman Capote didn't think much of To Kill a Mockingbird either. You don't have to write a novel to be a writer. All you have to do is be interested in the world, in the people, and listen to the story. She could have written a book review. She could have written a short story. She could have done what I did, which is go to a place, talk to people, and write about it. In her whole life, she never did that. She wrote the book, Flukarama. She had two editors kind of egging her on. The book comes out. It's like winning the lottery. And then she's like a lottery winner in seclusion. She's there with tons of money. They want me to write a novel, but I'm not going to write another novel. Well, don't write a novel. Write about your experiences with Truman Capote in Cold Blood. She could have written a terrific portrait of Capote. Didn't do it. So the woman's a mystery to me, but I think not a writer. I don't see her at all in that way. Maybe I'm in a minority in that way, but, you know, life is too short to read poor books. So I'm not that interested in it. But she's, I think, an insignificant writer, probably a very nice person.
Paul Theroux, before we went on the air, you mentioned a year ago you were in India. Is that going to be your next book then?
No. What I'd like to write, here's my ambition. People of my age, I'm 74, write a memoir, an autobiography. I mean, some haven't done it. Faulkner didn't do it. Styron didn't do it. Mailer didn't do it. But so many have done it. Saul Bellow didn't do it. But lots have, or they look for a biographer. Dickens was going to write one, but what did he do instead? He wrote David Copperfield. My next book, or a book that I would love to write, is my David Copperfield. I'm not going to write my autobiography. But I would like to write a novel about my life, maybe about my family, maybe, you know, somewhat related to how I've lived my life, instead of a memoir of my life in hard times.
You planning on any more travel books, a follow-up to Deep South?
I haven't thought of a book. There's a lot of travel I'd like to do, though. I mean, a lot of returning to places is very interesting. Some you can't return to, like Syria. I'm very interested in the Mexican border. Interests me a lot. Things have been written about it. But if you ask me where I'd like to go to the Mexican border, and I would like to go to a place that people are leaving. You know, people are streaming out of the Middle East. They're streaming out of the Philippines. They're streaming out of Africa. I'd like to go to this place, one of these places. Eritrea fought for its independence. 100,000 people died in Eritrea. what's happening in Eritrea? People are saying, screw it, I'm leaving, I'm going out. These great nationalists, they want to go to Germany. They don't want to go. So I'd like to go to one of these countries that people are leaving, that people are emigrating from. Look at that. That's a kind of vital subject.
On the other hand, they're leaving because it's not safe.
They're leaving because it's not safe, they're not happy, or they're greedy, or opportunistic, or really poor, or desperate. Or they get money, they just sold their house, like a lot of Syrians, sell a house, give money to a people trafficker, and then move to Frankfurt, Germany, and live in public housing, you know. So, not safe, but, you know, if I was looking for a safe life, I would have stayed home and opened a nail salon. But I didn't.
There is a weird little subtext in Deep South about all of the Indians who've gone to Africa and the Deep South and elsewhere and opened these motels and these, I mean, they've all left.
Well, there are 1.3 billion Indians. Most of them would like to move to the States. Many do. The ones that I spoke to came as students and stayed. The world is full of people. And man is an invasive species. They've completely screwed up their countries, China, India, Africa. What's the next solution? Leave. So go to Nigeria and find people who want to go to Texas. I mean, go to Houston, Texas. It's full of Nigerians. I've had, on this trip that I've just taken, where I've come to see you, I've had a number of taxi drivers. None of them have been native-born. All of them are either from Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Eritrea, China. So one of the features of life that my children and grandchildren, especially grandchildren, will face is the pressure of people wanting to come to America to have a life. When you're talking about the billions of people want to come here, billions. So the life of the United States, you know, cultural life, the texture of life is changing. It's not a world that I can easily envision, but you can see it manifested and you can see a transition now. And it will look like, in some places, like Mad Max, obviously.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose latest book is Deep South, its latest travel book. Also recently out, Mr. Bones, collection of short stories, and a 1978 novel, Picture Palace, in paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.